is here for you.
Gentlemen, today is Wednesday, April 19th, 2017, and I am opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be doing two work sessions on two of our smaller agencies, and contrary to what the agenda says, we're going to start first by opening a work session on House Bill 5024 related to the Board of Nursing. Mr. John Levitt, the floor is yours.
Members, HB 5024 is the budget bill for the State Board of Nursing. It is an other funds agency. It's supported by fees on the regulated profession. LFO recommends a total budget of $17,045,990, which is 49 positions and 48.9 FTE. This is essentially a current service level budget. Moving to the adjustments to the current service level, there is one adjustment, which is $541,123, which is to classify several positions and to permanently establish two full-term positions, full-time positions that had been approved by the emergency board on a limited term basis. So those are the adjustments to the current service level.
Okay, anything in particular that you want the committee to be aware of besides that?
Well, I would just note that we did take out the statewide adjustments for DAS and AG costs. We'll add those back at the end of session in a
reconciliation
bill.
Okay, good. Questions from the committee about this? All right, Mr. Co-Chair, I would appreciate a motion.
Yeah, do we have a recommendation from LFO?
Yeah,
That is the LFO recommendation.
So to include the adjustments.
Yeah.
All right. So, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5024.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Moves the LFO recommendation to 5024. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. Key performance measures.
So LFO is proposing to adjust three key performance measures, and these are measures where the board has exceeded the target in four of the past 5 years. Specifically, there's a reduction in recidivism performance measure. Also, there's an online business transactions measure and timely licensing measure. In each of those cases, we're moving the performance measure to more closely reflect the board's performance in recent years.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions about the key performance measures? Mr. Co-Chair?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move the LFO recommendation on the key performance measures.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendation on the key performance measures. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. And then we have a dash one.
So for the dash one, the LFO recommends a budget of $17,045,990 other funds and 49 positions, 48.9 FTE, which is reflected in the dash one amendment.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 5024.
Mr. Co-Chair moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 5024. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved.
LFO recommends that House Bill 5024, as amended by the dash one amendment, be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 5024 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
As amended by the dash one?
Yep, that's what I said, as amended.
Okay. Oh, as amended.
Yeah.
Cool. There we go. Mr. Co-Chair moves the House Bill 5024 as amended by the dash ones to the full committee of Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. Mr. Co-Chair, you want to carry this one in full?
I'll carry the nursing board in full. Absolutely. It would be a pleasure.
Okay, cool. And then Representative Malmstrom, would you like to take this on the floor?
Sure.
I'd be glad to. Cool. Then we'll let Senator Montes Anderson take this in the House. In the Senate, I mean. Thank you. Senate. Yes, you know what I meant.
We could send her over. It'd be fun.
Yeah, no, no, no. It would be fun, but she spent her time there. Okay, any other discussion on 5024? If not, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 5024 and opening a work session on House Bill 5023 related to the medical board. Mr. Jolivet, the floor is yours again.
Madam Chair and members, LFO, this is an other funds agency, again, supported by fees on the profession. LFO recommends a total budget of $12,941,528, 40 positions, 40 FTE. It represents approximately a 3% increase over the current service level. It includes packages totaling about $407,000. Most of that is workload related, addressing workload and licensing and investigations. Also, there is a one-time other funds increase of $175,000 to develop and implement local physician wellness programs. And one late adjustment that we made to this budget that I'd like to call to your attention is a shift of $10,750 other funds from services and supplies to personal services, and this is to reclassify an existing IT position to support the department's customized database. As for adjustments to the current service level, there aren't any similar to the last budget. The statewide adjustments have been removed. They'll be added back at the end of session, and that is the LFO recommendation.
Thank you. Mr. Kocher.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5023.
Mr. Kocher moves the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5023. Is there any discussion?
I have one question.
Certainly.
And the question is on the shift for reclassification purpose. What was the reason for having to reclassify? Were they at the top of the step, or what occurred?
I believe that this is to assist the department in recruiting difficult to hire IT position. The funds in their services and supplies were being used to contract for vendor services, but they found that that was increasingly difficult to do as their system aged, and they made some modifications that in-house staff were particularly good at dealing with.
We're having quite a conversation and cost containment about this whole issue of steps and reclassification, so I needed that clarification.
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Senator. Okay, is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved. Key performance measures.
The LFO is recommending two adjustments here. There's a key performance related to board best practices and a measure related to license efficiency. In both of these instances, the board has been exceeding the target that had been set, and this is an adjustment to move the performance measure more in line with what they've been reporting.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations on key performance measures.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendations on key performance measures. Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved.
Recommended changes. So the LFO recommends a budget of $12,941,528 other funds and 40 positions, 40 FTE, which is reflected in the dash one amendment.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the dash one amendment to House Bill 5023.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 5023. Discussion? Yes.
I'm just curious, why don't we ever have cents on the back of these budgets? They're always round dollars. What's going on in LFO?
Mr.
It's just hard to remember the census.
Okay.
And nonsenses.
Okay.
Senator Winters. Somebody's sharp this morning. Must be all that leftover birthday juice. Excellent. All right. Is there any opposition to this motion? If not, so moved.
LFO recommends that House Bill 5023, as amended by the dash one, be moved to the Ways and Means full committee.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
All right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 5023 is amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves House Bill 5023 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, So moved. To follow suit, I'll take it in full. Representative Beeler, would you kind of take this on the House floor?
Sure. Can I just ask a question about key performance metrics?
Sure, and I'll take it in the Senate.
It's just puzzling to me that we voted to decrease the targets. The board's doing great, but we either kept the same targets that they're hitting at 100% routinely, or we decreased the targets.
What did we decrease?
And so why would we want to?
Which one did we decrease?
We kept the target the same, but the board is actually already overperforming on like customer satisfaction and renewing licensing efficiently, or rather, monitors license with board orders and corrective action. So they're routinely like number four. They reported 5.15, and the target was 6. We kept it at 6. I mean, how useful is that? What's the rationale for making that decision?
So my approach was to look at the reported results for the last 5 years, and if the board had exceeded the target in most of those years, then I discussed with them the possibility of adjusting the target to incentivize them to continue to improve performance. If the key performance measures, the last reported was kind of up and down, and then I generally felt that we should keep the target where it was so long as they...
Okay, so you're looking at more than just the 2 years that's
correct.
There.
Yeah.
And then how often do we change these or add a key performance metrics?
Biannually, generally. I mean, we can change them in the interim, but generally we change them with their budgets on a biennial basis.
But I mean the actual target itself, not the number.
At the target when we redo their budgets.
Yeah, not the target, but what we're measuring.
Oh.
So we didn't add anything here.
Right. Right.
So it's just puzzling to me. The board's doing great, but isn't there something else that they can do great that we can, substitute for something that they're getting 100% routinely? I mean,
It's a valid question, and it is something that comes up fairly regularly. In some cases, there are significant changes to key performance measures. These two agencies, there aren't a lot of different ones, at least on the, this is the third time I've been through these two budgets, Senator Winters many more times than I.
Yeah.
And because of your experience, because you're chronologically advantaged, Senator. And I think that we've had the conversation about the KPMs for both of these boards. To be blunt, the medical board was not doing so well in my first session here. And they were some fairly robust conversations then, and fortunately that has changed. But these are the ones that stakeholders seem to think are relevant. But we will have other agencies coming up, maybe not so much before this committee, a little bit maybe, where we will change the key performance measures. Or we will direct with a budget note that the agency needs to come back with recommendations for new KPMs. But it's an ongoing conversation that the LFO analysts have with the agencies during the budget preparation process. So even last summer, they were having these conversations about this.
And I'm asking this question more since this is the first time I've ever gone
sure.
through this process and to see how it's generated.
Just to add some context, and it goes back to probably Mr. Chair, 2003, and those. We also had what's called Oregon Progress Board, where we actually, it was our attempt to begin looking at outcomes of agencies, and this one is no different, and it's taken a lot of years to evolve where you're at the point where we went to KPMs to make them relevant to the actual activity of the of whichever board that we're right. we're working with. And as their activities may or may not change, then you may or may not change the KPMs. The targets are set through, you know, talking about the realistically what we think or and they think they can accomplish, rather than trying to put a target that is not realistic, but it's something that we may dream that they can hit. And so that's kind of, and you will find that with all the agencies that come before us, LFO, in working with the agencies, I believe do an outstanding job. It, like I said, it took us years to get to this point. You know, because as you know, sometimes we on this side, you know, think that there should be a particular objective, and then you'll find that actually it's not as realistic with the actual work that is going on within a particular agency. But we do have the opportunities to input through not only the discussion here on the panel, but also, you know, sometimes it'll even crop up in your policy committees that they might even suggest.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, and you're cool with carrying this on the House floor?
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 5023. Mr. Gelidet, thank you for your assistance. And I'm now going to be, Ms. Ames, do you want me to open
She's
work?
Right,
I know, I'm asking your question. Do you want
Just
me to open here? Both? Okay. I'm opening public hearings on House Bill 5026, the Oregon Health Authority, and House Bill 5027, the OHA fee ratification bill. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, and now we're back to OHA. So today we're going to hear about the various fee establishments and increases that are included in the OHA budget for 17-19. You've hit on them a little bit as we went through phase one, but especially on the public health fees, I didn't feel like you really had enough information for you to make these final decisions when work session does finally come around. There are seven fees in public health and one fee in the health information technology program. The health information technology program, you did hear more about in phase one, so we're actually today going to start out with public health and go to that fee towards the end. So in terms of approving fees, I did want to go back through the process because it can be a little confusing. And there are different processes for fee approvals depending on the circumstances. So first, two of these fees that we're going to talk about were established or increased in the interim through an administrative process that requires DAS approval of the fee. Both of those fees came out of policy bills that were passed that required a fee to implement. The legislature must not then ratify the fees for them to continue on. And this is done in the fee ratification bill, the House Bill 5027, and we will work that bill along with the regular budget bill when we get to work session. Sometimes fees are in statute. This is the case for two of these fees. In this case, the policy bill that allows the fee increase comes to Ways and Means after it's finished working in the policy committee, so that it can be passed along with the agency's budget so that we have all the pieces that go together and are consistent. And finally, four of the fee establishments or increases are proposed in the budget for 17-19.
Mm-hmm.
In these kind of cases, if the budget is approved, then the agency will move forward with the administrative process to increase the fees. And then they're going to go through them really one by one and kind of explain which pot they're in and the details of each fee. I did want to alert you on OLIS. The document that's labeled the fee presentation is what you're seeing here. It's the high-level materials to go through each fee. There is also a document called the fee detail that has all the gory detail. The agency isn't planning to go through that, but it's there for your reference. And I'll just warn you, when we say a fee, it isn't usually a fee. It's usually a whole fee schedule. And so you'll see some of what we call a fee is actually 30 or 40 lines of things. And so it's a little, once again, a little more complicated. And that's what I have.
Okay. Sounds like we have Ms. Slothauer and Ms. Otter to talk with us.
Good morning, co-chairs, Senator Simon Hayward and Representative Rayfield and members of the committee. My name is Karen Slothauer, and I'm the Director of Fiscal and Business Services for the Public Health Division. And this morning I'm here to walk you through or to go over a quick overview of the fees that are in the public health budget. I'm sorry, the OHA budget and policy option package 409. Which are part of House Bill 5026 and 5027. Okay. So Ms. Ames has provided you an overall process, the overall process steps of how fees are established. So I'm going to actually go ahead and skip the first two slides here, which just gives you a little bit of the detail for your reference. Fee-related programs have multiple cost drivers as we start with statutory requirements. In some programs, it's possible to get to economies of scale, like vital records and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. Other programs, like hospice agency and in-home care agency, licensure and compliance oversight, often require off-site reviews and can be time-consuming and costly because they require multiple record reviews and travel. It may be that one staff member can only perform one or two reviews in a week, whereas the staff working in another program can process hundreds of applications or records requests. When evaluating the fee levels, the division starts by performing an analysis of ongoing workload, revenue, and expenditures. When it's determined fee increases might be necessary, the program will reach out to stakeholders to notify them of the potential changes. Rural advisory committees are established as an opportunity for stakeholder input into the process and into the changes in any of the proposed rules. When final drafts have been completed, they're published and scheduled for public hearing. The other thing that we look at is a comparison of to other states. Fees in other states, as that's part of the analysis. And as an example of that, the agency gathered information from other states during its review and analysis for the newborn metabolic screening test kit fees. The Oregon fee is presently at $64 for two screens, and the proposed fee increases to $80 for two screens. Other states can charge anywhere from $77 in Wyoming to $135 in Delaware for a two-screen kit, and Colorado is in the middle at $92. So that's just an example of some of the benchmarking that we do. So the Public Health Division budget includes seven fee requests, and going back to Ms. Ames' explanation of the different ways fees are established, we have fees in each one of these categories. So the division's requesting ratification of two interim fee establishment increases approved by the Department of Administrative Services as part of the Senate Bill 333 process. The next two, hospice licensing and in-home care licensing fees, are associated with statutory changes through Senate Bill 53, which increases the statutory cap. The third category prospectively approves fees through the administrative rule. The first fee that I'd like to talk about is the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, otherwise known as ORLAP. You may recall that under House Bill 3400 that passed in the 2015 session, the Public Health Lab is required to accredit any laboratory conducting testing of marijuana and products that is seeking licensure by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Adding marijuana to the accreditation standard required adding advanced technology requirements as part of the process. this advanced field of technology testing is necessary for some other things beyond cannabis, such as some testing of drinking water, air, soil samples, etc. ORLAP worked closely with its advisory board, and four new fees were established. The amounts of the fees range from $150 to $1,440. And this fee is expected to apply to 80 laboratories in Oregon and an additional 12 laboratories out of state. The revenue projection is consistent with the staffing level for the public health lab that was also approved 2 years ago. The next fee is a step.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious, when you increase the fees, I mean, sometimes you increase them to a certain level to sustain, you know, the program over a period of years, where you might create a revenue, you have like a little excess, which then sustains the program over a period, and then you have to re-up those fees later on. And so what were these fees based on over a long period of time, and then when do you expect to have to come back, or do you know?
Well, when we look at fee setting, we primarily try to look at least two biennia ahead. So we are, all of the fees that are represented here, we are projecting positive cash balances through 1921 at least.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So this is establishing fees for the Toxic Free Kids Act. So the Toxic Free Kids Act, Senate Bill 478 in 2015, directed the Oregon Health Authority to establish a program for manufacturers of certain children's products to report the presence of 66 high-priority chemicals of concern for children's health, and to eventually remove, substitute, or retain a waiver for those chemicals present in children's products that are mouthable, such as a children's cosmetic, or made for, marketed for use by, or marketed to children under 3 years of age. So this description is a very this description simplifies, actually, a very complex program that addresses high priority chemicals of concern in children's products. So these fees, because of the early implementation, went through, I'm sorry, not early implementation, but because of the implementation date, went through the Senate Bill 333 process, and we're asking for ratification of the fees.
Can I ask a clarification? Sure, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, chairs, co-chairs. On the Toxic Free Kids, can you give us just a brief, I don't want to take too much time on this, but kind of a brief synopsis of how that database is going, who the vendor is, and kind of give us an update. In other words, the question is, will the state be ready to receive the data and have everything online by the time that the manufacturers are required to report it?
Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Hayden. That's a little bit outside of my content expertise, so I actually have with me Gabriella Goldfarb, who is the section manager for that program, who I'd like to invite up here to answer that question.
Good morning, Chair Steiner-Hayward, Chair Rayfield. My name is, for the record, I'm Gabriella Goldfarb, Environmental Public Health Section Manager for the Oregon Health Authority in the Public Health Division. Chairs, Rep. Hayden, the statute provided a couple of pathways, or the effect of the statute was to provide a couple of options for how we do that database. As you know better than I, there's a lot of concern about doing database projects correctly. The options were to try to use Washington State's system. That would be quick and hopefully low cost. But an evaluation but the statute also contemplated another path to use an interstate chemical clearinghouse, an interstate organization, to do that work. That would have an advantage that the manufacturers were interested in of allowing a one place that manufacturers from multiple states could submit to satisfy the requirements of similar programs in multiple states. The technical evaluation of Washington's database found that it would not meet the needs of Oregon's statute, And so the Health Authority got a grant, a $500,000 grant from EPA to fund the development through this interstate clearinghouse of the database. Because of that concern about doing it right, we have spent a lot of time developing a strong governance oversight committee for this project. That's just getting concluded. It is going to delay the implementation of the database for it still will be ready before the date that reporting is due, but we are interested in seeing how to give manufacturers a bigger window to comply in advance of that date. So there's some conversations going on about that. We're about to let that contract probably in May, and that'll give us firm timelines when we'll be able to come back and talk about exact timelines for that project.
So just quick follow-up. So from what I'm understanding is that you're putting out an RFP or something for that vendor. We don't have that vendor identified to tweak this interstate process, or put that in language I can understand.
Sure. Co-chairs, Hayden. The statute identified the vendor as the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse. So that is in the statute, and that is who we are working through. We would do a subcontract of our EPA grant to that interstate organization, and they have developed other databases for interstate, you know, processes, and so that's those are all the known quantities. The issue was, because we're subcontracting, because it's not in our, it's an IT project, not in our direct control, our Office of Information Services wanted a really robust governance system. So we've gotten multiple IT experts from multiple states to serve on that committee, for example. And that's what we're doing a lot of work at the front end to make sure that we have hopefully a bulletproof process to create a database, you know, knock.
So this is going to be smooth, right?
That's if we do the upfront work, hopefully the implementation will go smooth.
Okay. Thank you.
And you expect full implementation when? What year?
So the so co-chairs, Rep. Bueller, the program has different components. So one, the heart of it is manufacturers reporting chemicals that may be in their products, but there's other parts of it having to do with there's chemicals that are intentionally added to a manufacturing process. There are chemicals that are contaminants that are byproducts of manufacturing that are not intentionally there. And if they're above a certain level, the manufacturers have to either apply, you know, comply with certain level restrictions, or they have to implement a what's called a manufacturing control program. I'm sorry, this gets very technical very quickly. And so there's part of the program that they can already start doing this year. They can apply for essentially an exemption. And so we're expecting to see those this year. We're in a couple weeks going to be releasing the guidance for that. So part of that is already, so part of the program will already be, you know, start to kick in its intended form. The reporting of chemicals will happen, you know, late in this year. That's when we're expecting it to go online.
Yeah.
So I didn't hear an answer of full implementation. When do you expect the full implementation to be done? What year?
You know what? I'm going to have to circle back and get back to you, because I have a certain level of expertise, but I have staff who are really have a very detailed expertise. So we can circle back with kind of a detailed timeline.
There are actually two parts. There are two different sets of answers to that question. Okay. There's the part that has to do with the technical implementation on the part of OHA. There are also the statutory pieces that, with what we passed in 2015, that relate to when manufacturers need to report or apply for exemptions or phase things out of products, mm-hmm. Or apply for an exemption that they can't phase it out. So I don't know whether you're asking about the technical implementation or the statutory pieces. I can't claim to remember what the statutory. Yeah. Okay.
Oh. Yes. When it's fully implemented, what do you think the cost of this program will be?
I will have to circle back with that information.
The fees listed in the schedule bring in a total of about $625,000 for the biennium, if I read your mm-hmm. something like that. $600,000 for the biennium, and that's expected to cover
the costs for running the program?
Yes. This fee structure, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go, please answer.
I'm sorry, co-chairs, members of the committee. This fee structure is very complex, and it is actually expected to cover the program through the disclosure fees that are required currently in statute by January 1st of 2018. Those fees are anticipated to be one-time fees that will cover the cost of the program for the next few biennia. So the disclosure fees that people have to report, there will be a collection of those that carry forward as and pay for the ongoing costs. The last estimate, and this is an estimate, but the last estimate of the program cost was approximately $420,000 a year. I'm sorry, a biennium. And so that's what the costs, and again, that's an estimate, but that was the last known estimate that we had.
So I know you have a question, Representative Rayfield, but I want to clarify something you just said. So if I understand you correctly, the fees that are listed in this in your associated document with all the fee detail, those disclosure fees and request for exemption fees, except for the refundable part, those are one-time fees. Once you've done it, you don't have to do it again unless something changes. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, that there's a requirement to disclose and then a requirement to report, an ongoing requirement to report, but that disclosure happens one time.
And the reporting does not require an additional fee?
That's my understanding.
Good. So we're not billing people over and over again for doing the same thing.
Yes.
That's good to know. All right. Representative Rayfield, please, Chief.
So just a couple of questions. The first one, the website or the product, we got a $500,000 grant for that. Is that going to be enough to cover the full cost of the project, or should we expect you coming back to us saying, hey, we need additional funding, or how might that work? I'm just kind of trying to project out into the future what the cost might be.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, we anticipate that that funding will cover the cost of developing a database. There is a provision of the bill that discusses a website that the public can interface that data. That part we do not yet have funding for, but the database itself, which is required for compliance. So we will need to be working on how we make that information transparent to the public. We would be interested eventually in having that website interface, but that's distinct from the database that's needed to capture the information. And in one way or another, we can report on that.
The statute that we passed in 2015 requires the creation of a website so the public can see this information. And so, is that correct understanding? Then, have you guys looked at what the cost of creating that website the statute requires, and then when might we, which biennium might we see that coming to the sub?
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, I will have to get back to you about that. I joined the Health Authority a few months ago, and so I've been coming up to speed on this, but I'm not as familiar with the details, so I'll respond to that. I do believe that the statute made it subject to available funding.
Okay. And one more follow-up. I actually remember from our last conversation, because I asked a few questions on this about, because I know we are putting some general fund, and I think it was $229,000 from the putting towards this program, and then we have the fees that then fund the other component. Part of my question last time was, were we going to need more general fund in this biennium or the next biennium as the program ramps up? But what I just heard you say is that, that we passed this bill in 2015, so I'm really stretching my memory. But once we once we get into this latter portion of the program, there is an expansion of work and things that have to be done under the statute, which I do remember of the phases, right? And so what my question is, when we get to that part, which I think you told Representative Buehler you don't have the actual cost, but are we expecting that we're going to need an increase in general fund to then fund that latter half of the component as we project out into future bienniums?
So I would say it is our, we anticipate that the that we wouldn't need an increase in general fund, that the fees are intended to cover that expansion. But I will say, I'm sorry, co-chairs and members of the committee, I will say this is a very, you all know better than me because you were there. This is a very complex program. I Rep. Kenny Geyer mentioned 20 dash amendments to get it into the current place. And it's different. It's similar to programs in other states, but we have our own kind of unique components. And so and it involves manufacturing, which is a complex process. So I think we are moving very deliberately to do go step by step. We will keep this committee informed about how that implementation goes. We're confident that it will work out as intended, but we're going to be learning along the way, and we'll have to make adjustments.
And one last follow-up on the actual fees themselves to make sure I understand them. So I'm actually looking at 5027, the bill itself. There's the chemical disclosure, $250. The exemption request, which is, I think what you were mentioning, where we say that there's no other alternatives. Here's our request for an exemption. It's a the $1,500 is non-refundable, and then it says refundable is $12,000. So does that mean that someone would submit a check for $13,500, and then the potentially this refundable amount gets refunded back to them? Is the $12,000 a cap as well, or which where if the expenses were higher that we OHA would have to then bear the cost of anything higher than that? So I guess those are kind of I'm trying to understand the actual fees.
Sure, thank you, co-chairs. Merp Rayfield in particular, that $12,000 fee will be charged. Was this the reason that was that system was set up? Is because as the health authority, we aren't chemical engineers, and so it was contemplated from the beginning that we would be contracting with consultants to do that work. But we couldn't set up a fee legally that would just allow us to charge $200 an hour, which was is the estimated amount. And so the workaround was to charge fees in increments of $12,000. Anything that was unused, and the estimated rate was $200 an hour with a, an estimate of 60, well, I may be doing the math wrong, 60 hours. But again, this is a new process, so these were our best guess. If it takes less than 60 hours, we would refund anything that was not needed to carry out that work. If it took more than 60 hours, the manufacturer would have to submit another $12,000 increment that, again, would be refund, you know, any part of that. If just 1 or 2 hours of that were required to finish out the work, then the rest of it would all go back to the manufacturer. So it was just a way to, you know, how do we get chunks of money that allow us to hire a consultant to do those reviews for us?
So just to summarize, there's no long-term exposure to the Oregon Health Authority because we haven't put a cap in place.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Good.
And
moving right along. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative, I missed some of
it's
them.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair and Co-Chair. This is a kind of added to what Representative Rayfield brought on in respect to your website. So I think it's great that there's a lot of focus on the database. But if you don't have a platform in which to share that information, manufacturing companies, other folks from my, communication, understanding processes, they're not going to, we don't have that information now. They'll be calling your office all the time. And I know that from experience.
Sure.
So I'm actually really surprised that part of the fees that you that are being charged, that part of that money isn't going to pay for a website development. And the maintenance, of course, because it, you know, it's ongoing once you establish a website. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what can happen at this point, but some of that, I don't know. Just wanted to bring that up, but that's, you know, a necessary way to communicate with folks, with the public, and not to have that as part of the thinking from its original components.
I get a little bit complicated.
Co-chairs, Representative Alonso León, our intention is to provide information to the public about this. And having the data and having staff resources on staff to interpret that data, we should be able to provide information to the public in some, you know, in some accessible way on our website. But maybe it's not an interactive website, which would require something new. But I think that, you know, once we have the heart of the enterprise constructed, it'll be an easier step to then think about how do we maybe have a website that is really easily accessible. But I think we can commit to providing that information to the public in ways that are relevant to them, that they can get information about products that their children have access to.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair. Just one last question on this. I think an important aspect for the 2015 legislation was to drive this to public information. And if you look at Vermont, you're looking at a more limited scope than the legislation that was passed in 2015, and they had a million plus reports. How do you take that sheer, what is your plan, or have you contemplated, or my suggestion would be to contemplate, how do you take a million, maybe Oregon, since it's a broader scope, will be 2 million, I don't know, 1.2 million, how do you take that volume of reports and break it down to something that I can understand as general public? How do you do that?
So, Co-Chairs, Rep. Hayden, my understanding is that the Vermont, I need to go back and really pin this down, but my understanding is that the Vermont program is more expansive than Oregon's program. We are following the 66 chemicals, the list that was established out of the state of Washington and University of Washington. And so I don't know that we are talking about the same scale as the Vermont program, and I know there's some other differences with that. But we can circle back with a comparison and how we intend to deal with that information.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. How big of a legislative fix would it take to align our legislation with other states so that we could be involved in an interstate compact to do some of this work?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, the intention of the reason that Oregon got the grant, the $500,000 grant from EPA, is because this is going to be an interstate database that all manufacturers can report to and satisfy the requirements of the multiple states that have similar programs.
Yeah, please.
But I thought you said earlier that our legislation wasn't in sufficient alignment with the state of Washington to do that.
Co-chairs, Rep. Bueller, yes, that it was not aligned sufficiently for us to use the state of Washington's database as off the shelf, but the database that is being constructed by the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse is going to have the capacity to take reports from manufacturers that satisfy all of the states.
Okay.
But the point is well taken. I mean, why we couldn't have a website that's the same, why we couldn't work with other states that are doing the same thing like Washington to create a joint website that's based on the data that comes from that interstate database is an interesting question.
Make a comment. As our federal government becomes more dysfunctional, and as we
not very optimistic.
For variety reasons, it's a bipartisan problem. So. We should keep in mind this option of interstate compacts. Yeah, it's as old as the Republic, and it was instituted to take care of this situation when our federal government is not very effective, especially for new programs. You know, it's hard to create effective interstate compacts on old programs because states get down the road on what they're doing. But something new like this, it's a really great option, and it has robust experience and legal basis to do it.
Yeah, and we do use it for lots of other areas for certain kinds of licensing, although not all, and extradition, for that matter, is an interstate compact issue. I mean, there's all sorts of areas where we use it.
Okay, I think we've badgered you enough on this issue. Thank you for all the clarifications, Ms. Goldfarb. Thanks for what you added.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Okay, so the next fee is hospice and in-home licensing fees. Senate Bill 53, the session, requests increases in hospice agency licensure fees and in-home care agency licensure fees paid to the Oregon Health Authority to fund personal services and operating expenses to support the current requirements as defined in statute. The fee authority is authorized under ORS 443.860 and ORS 443.315. The bill supports fee changes requested in this policy option package, which will fund the current service level that is presently included in the 2017-19 governor's budget. No new services are proposed, and no new position authority is requested. The fee increase allows the Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement Program in OHA to maintain the funding needed for a client care surveyor position, revenue generated from the current hospice agency and in-home care agency licensure fees no longer support the cost of this program. Sorry.
No, it's fine. Senator Gilster.
Thank you. And I had made a commitment to make a comment on this POP in the committee. We had the bill in the policy committee. We got a little stuck for a while, and the bill was amended, and it's coming here without the full resource in it that the organization had hoped for. And we started to have a conversation about, you know, what's the balance of what should be general fund supported in terms of licensing and survey efforts, and what should be supported by the licensing fees that are charged to the organization. So I believe where we landed put the department in an okay place for this biennium, but left a pretty significant, maybe about $1 million hole in the second biennium, and the idea was that we could further discuss that issue and that bigger idea of the balance between general fund and licensing fees in the budget committee.
Thank you.
Is that accurate? Just did I? It's important to keep your promises.
Okay. So moving along, healthcare facility license, healthcare facility construction plan review fees. The healthcare facility construction plan review customers include acute and long-term care facilities. Many of the facilities are required to be certified to receive Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements for services that they provide. As new construction is being planned, the OHA is required to conduct a review of these plans to ensure all specifications and requirements are met before the facility can proceed with construction. The OHA program has 4 staff currently conducting this workload for approximately 800 facilities. Fees generally break down into 3 categories. This is proposed changes to existing residential care facilities or assisted living facilities, proposed changes to existing acute care facilities, such as ambulatory surgery centers, birthing centers, and hospitals, and review of new facilities. This fee, I think the next page. So this fee is a result of the revenue no longer covering the costs of the program.
With these increases, will you cover the entire cost of the program? And again, is this, how long do you expect it to cover the cost of the program? And what do you have, expect new increases?
This fee is expected to cover the cost of the program, and it does move us into the 1921 biennium with a balanced budget, or with a projected balanced budget, yes. Okay, so the alert system is the Oregon Immunization Program's immunization registry, and public health is proposing to implement a $5 per record fee in 2017-19. Authority for this fee was granted in 2003 at $10 per record. However, the program has been utilizing a clause in the rule that allows for donations in lieu of fees. In evaluation of the cost against the donation revenues, it has been determined that a more consistent revenue funding stream is required to fund the management and operation of the registry. The program believes that actually $5 per record charge will cover the cost of the program through the 1921 biennium.
I'm curious about one thing about this as somebody who spends a lot of time using that system. At least in my electronic health record with my doctor hat on, it's integrated in. I mean, I can get straight into ImmuneAlert from without going to an external source. Does that mean that every time my MA goes in and pulls down records from ImmuneAlert, there's going to be a fee for this? Or is it only going to be for individuals requesting this? How's that exactly going to work?
Co-chairs, members of the committee. My understanding about this, and I do have a content expert with me, but my understanding about this is the fee applies to health plans and who are doing or who are pulling records for quality improvement exercises and not for providers.
Great. Thank you very much. I see somebody nodding in the back room. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that on the record because I could hear a bunch of pediatricians and family doctors' stomachs clenching across the state at the thought of a $5 per record fee. Yeah. So, okay. That makes good sense.
Yes, and actually the flipping the slide, go ahead, and authorized users, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Public Health elected the newborn metabolic screening test kit fee increase. I talked about this one a little earlier. So some background. In 1963, Oregon was one of two states to mandate newborn screening of infants. In 1977, the Oregon Public Health Lab formed the Northwest Regional Newborn Screening Program with several other states. Currently, the Public Health Lab conducts newborn screening for Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, New Mexico, as well as Guam, Saipan, and several military bases and several Navajo clinics. Mouthful. The Public Health Lab generally follows the recommended uniform screening panel issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. The Public Health Lab must meet specific requirements issued by the College of American Pathologists to maintain its accreditation. The overall operations of the Public Health Lab is largely funded by fees, and newborn screening is the largest segment of that of the Public Health Lab operations and of their budget and their operations. Newborn screening kits are sold to Oregon birthing facilities and providers who in turn return the samples to the Oregon Public Health Lab for testing. As discussed earlier, the Public Health Lab conducts two tests on all Oregon births. So the charges to the four other states and the regional program is currently set at $100 per two-screen kit. Approximately 61 of the test samples and 66% of the revenue come from the four other states as part of the regional program. The cost of newborn screening kits was adjusted to $64 in 2014 in order to provide for the additional screening of SCID, the severe immunodeficiency syndrome. The Public Health Lab is proposing to increase Oregon charge to $80 effective October of this year, and projects that this will provide stable funding of public health operational costs and staffing through 1921. The increase is expected to provide revenue for ongoing staffing and supply costs, capital expenditures of new equipment to allow for technology enhancements, and the addition of genetic marker testing for cystic fibrosis.
And I assume that this does not include the fiscal associated with Senate Bill 808 were that to move forward, which has a fiscal of something on the order of $1.5 million.
Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, that is correct.
Thank you.
Let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
I would say to the members of the committee, if you ever get a chance, go and tour the lab. It is so
it
amazing.
Is. Really? I've done that, and it's really interesting.
It's pretty neat. Yeah, that's one I haven't done yet, so I should go do that soon.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know this, the ability to screen newborns in this way is an enormous public health advance. I mean, even for relatively rare things like skin, you catch one of those at birth, and the cost savings and the life savings and the morbidity savings are enormous. I mean, there are all sorts of diseases that are eminently treatable by lifestyle modification or medication or whatever that we couldn't treat, and people ended up with significant developmental delay, with all sorts of other horrible things, or premature death. And now we can screen for all these things, and there are more all the time. So it's a pretty amazing process, the way we protect kids right from the get-go.
Okay. Thank you. I think that takes us through the public health fees.
Thank you, Ms. Lothar. One quick question before you, Ms. Lothar's coming and getting set up. We noticed that a lot of these fees have not been increased for quite some time. And could you talk a little bit about whether you have a plan for somewhat more? I mean, we're looking at increases on something on the order of 100 fees. I can't quite count all the lines because my eyes are old. But do you have a plan in place for going through these on a regular basis now so you don't end up behind the eight ball? Or are we going to just sort of wait and see how this plays out to see if your projections work? What's the plan?
Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, yes, we've actually been talking a lot about this. This is the second round, the second biennium of quite a few fee increases that have come forward. And one of the things that we've looked at is not only doing a robust evaluation of our fees every biennium, but also making sure that when we do come in to request new fees, that we're looking ahead at least that two biennia to make sure that we are not setting fees in a manner that's going to bring us back to you within the next budget period.
I'm actually more worried about you not coming back soon enough.
Right.
Because I don't really want you running a deficit. I mean, these should be essentially revenue neutral with a little bit of reserve at the end for, you know, the way we do with all other funds programs, which is essentially what these are.
Yes.
Right? These are other funds programs just like the medical board and the nursing board.
Yes.
They should be supported by user fees. So
yes.
I'm more worried about the latter circumstance than the former circumstance.
Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, yes, I agree, and I think that with our change in review each biennium, I think that we will be better positioned to make sure that we have those discussions with our LFO analyst and bring those forward much sooner.
Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks
for your help. Ms. Otter.
Good morning. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. I presented to you during phase one on the health information technology programs, including our Oregon Common Credentialing Program that I wanted to talk with you about today. So POP 409 establishes the fees and the other fund limitation for the Common Credentialing Program. This program is intended to centralize the collection, verification, and use of healthcare practitioner credentialing information for the purpose of minimizing practitioner burdens that exist today with duplicative processes when practitioners are credentialed with multiple organizations. We've worked closely with our stakeholders, our Common Credentialing Advisory Group, and subject matter experts to establish fee principles, a fee structure, and have assessed our budget conservatively to ensure that we are setting fee amounts to cover the costs of implementing and operating this program. The program fees will be charged to practitioners in a one-time setup fee to help offset the costs of implementing the program of $150 per practitioner. That will be paid once, and practitioners will not have to pay an annual fee ongoing, and that really is a setup fee to set up their record in the Common Credentialing Database. And then credentialing organizations will pay an initial setup fee to help offset the remaining costs for implementing the program. That's a very modest fee, between $10 and $26,000 per credentialing organization, depending on their practitioner panel size. And then credentialing organizations will really be, their fees will really cover the ongoing costs through an annual fee based on their practitioner panel size. So the tiered fee structure is in the gory details spreadsheet attachment that walks through how we've divided up practitioner panel sizes and their affiliated fees. Those fees range from $90 at the low end for an ambulatory surgical center or entity with one practitioner up to $195,000 for the largest health plans that have over 15,000 practitioners in their panel. I will just mention that the Oregon Health Authority is offsetting some of the budget in terms of covering staff costs with our existing budget and some Medicaid match, as well as a contribution from our provider directory program that will leverage the data that will be verified in the common credentialing program. So we expect that the state-funded portion of the provider directory will be offsetting costs as well by leveraging this data. So we've done what we can to reduce the total budget. We have been somewhat conservative in setting these fee amounts in that we want to ensure we can cover the costs of operating the program in alignment with the intention of the legislation. And so with that, we expect to implement the Common Credentialing Program in early 2018. That gives us some time to work through the exact costs. We've built in some contingencies, for example, in our budget that allow us 10% contingency in case our costs are higher than we think. So we'll have more information after the first year or so of the program to see if these fee amounts can be reduced.
Representative, thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So other than the cost, as far as the practicality of providers currently have to get credentialed with, you know, facilities, insurance companies, 10, 20, hundreds maybe, and each of those requests from those entities are often varying a lot in what they're asking for. And so my question is, as you try and get this as a common credentialing, what is the negotiation going on behind the scenes between one that might have a 10-page credentialing request with lifetime of everything you've ever breathed in your life versus, you know, we want to know your history for the last 5 years of some other ones? How do you bring that together? Or is it just going to be this huge stack with all these varying different questions put into one form, or are you going to come to a common form that is something reasonable?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden. So Oregon has an Oregon practitioner credentialing application, a common form that is mandated today. So credentialing organizations will be required to use that form and the data that are in the credentialing system and not ask practitioners separately for that information. Credentialing organizations, however, can ask practitioners for additional information that is not contained in that form. So we have aligned currently around a common form that meets the accreditation requirements that each credentialing organization must meet. What we see with credentialing organizations asking for additional information is often, in some cases, their bylaws, for example, for a hospital may require additional history beyond what their accrediting entity requires for that hospital for their credentialing processes. So to maximize the value that credentialing organizations have of the system that they'll be paying for, we will seek to help them identify efficiencies and look at their processes to say, do they really need to go above and beyond what their accrediting entity standards are and go back, for example, all the way to residency rather than back 10 years, which is for an example of what we see today. In addition, my point is that the credentialing organizations will still have the latitude to ask for additional information. They can't ask for it if it's in the system, and we've aligned to meet their accrediting entity requirements, but we'll work to see if we can get them to reduce some of those extra pieces. In addition, we have credentialing organizations that ask for separate information for their business processes that they need for their for other reasons besides credentialing. So we see disparate requests today, and we'll be looking at are there commonalities above and beyond what's needed for credentialing that we can centralize in a later phase. Does that make sense?
Yes, kind of, but it kind of gets to my point it may or may not reduce the request from the practitioners if each of these entities have the common form and then they have their internal bylaws form. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they all do that, where are we gaining ground is my question.
If I may.
Sure.
Ms. Lauer, thank you. Representative Hayden, I think that's a very important question, and it is analogous to the work that we did after legislation we passed in 2013 around telehealth credentialing, because we were having a situation where smaller rural hospitals that were having physicians at centers such as St. Charles or OHSU practice telehealth there to provide services in remote areas, do things like require them to go through HIPAA training again or get a TB test or, you know, whatever, and a new TB test, even though that had been done at their home site. And what we've seen after that work was done was sort of an agreement about what could or could not be asked as part of this process. And it's resulted in a significant narrowing of the variability in those credentialing requirements, especially for certain kinds of practice. Ultimately, we have to allow home organizations, whether it's an insurance company or a hospital, to have its own requirements. But the conversations that have happened, at least around the telehealth conversation, and you could get more information from the medical board, for example, about that process, has led a bunch of hospitals to reexamine their credentialing practices in general. And I think what I hear you saying, Ms. Otter, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're having those conversations with the credentialing organizations, whether they're hospitals or insurance plans or whatever, and you're starting to get that agreement that maybe you don't have to ask for somebody who's been out of residency 23 years, the way I have, what I've done since 1994, as opposed to what I've done over the last 10 years. So I think we are seeing some narrowing, and I think the work that you're doing will get us to that point for exactly the reason that you pointed out. I mean, it's really unnecessary, and it's time-consuming for the providers and their practices. Am I interpreting you correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you. One clarification. An increasing problem I see on the credentialing is different CME requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Are you addressing that in this project? I mean, one organization requires 30 a year, another 40 a year, another 20 a year, and then some then sub-classify CMEs and a certain type of CME. Is that part of this credentialing consolidation?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, I'm not sure on that technical question. I can get back to you on that.
To look into.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Okay. Did you have more, or are you good?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the OHA folks? Okay. If not, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5027. One quick note. Some of you may notice that Representative Bueller and I are wearing buttons that say 762. Which is the number of suicides that we had in Oregon last year. And Representative Bueller, do you want to talk briefly about what's happening today in that regard?
Thank you very, very much for that. And thank you, good senators, for helping out. So it's Suicide Awareness Day. We're having a lunch you're all invited to. We have a variety of speakers talking about the problem of suicide in Oregon, which, you know, there's more deaths from suicide now in Oregon every year than car accidents or even drug overdose, and those things certainly get a lot more attention than suicide. And as you can imagine, these are preventable deaths, so there's things that we should be doing to decrease it. So you'll also notice the number is 762, but it's angled downward, so our goal is to try to decrease the number of empty chairs, and you'll see a demonstration or out front which has 762 empty chairs, and hopefully next year it will be fewer chairs.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Anything else, Ms. Ames, for the good of the order?
Just a reminder that you don't have to come to the committee tomorrow.
Wow.
And next week we will be...
So we were just posting this morning, starting. We will not have a meeting on Monday either, but then we will have meetings Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Okay.
And we will do the behavioral health a couple days next week.
Could you send us an email to that?
Yeah.
They're pretty good about that. All right, anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned.